Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, here's to today's episode. We have something a little different on this week. On Saturday, we have the Tatler Women of the Year Awards. And at Davy, we are the proud lead sponsors of the awards this year. Jessie Collins is a Dublin-based editorial and content strategist with over two decades of experience crafting compelling brand narratives and leading multi-platform storytelling across Ireland's most respected media, lifestyle and cultural platforms. Through her career, she has steered award-winning editorial teams, launched pioneering investments and initiatives, and helped shape the content landscape for both print and digital. From relaunching Irish Tatler for the digital era to directing content for Image and Cara magazines, she has worked at the intersection of journalism, brand strategy and creative innovation. Irish Tatler is a long-running Irish women's magazine with a rich history dating back to the late 19th century. It was first published in 1890 under the name The Lady of the House, founded by John T. Macdonald, who was also the publisher of the Irish Independent. Its original mission was to provide practical advice and aspirational content for Irish women, covering fashion, society, household tips and culture. Today it continues to be a prominent voice in Irish media, celebrating female achievement and providing insight into fashion, culture and modern Irish life. This is perhaps best encapsulated by the Irish Tatler Women of the Year Awards. This year, celebrating its 25th anniversary, the awards have always been about championing the achievements of women while also being an opportunity to take stock of where we are in terms of equality, opportunity and progress. Jessie, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
A great place maybe to start is with Irish Tatler magazine itself. What's the core demographic of it today and how has that kind of evolved over the last 135 years?
Yeah, it's evolved a lot, obviously, because it now exists as part of the Business Post, as part of their publishing platform. So it's within that. So our audience is probably much more business focused, so more around what people might know as a reference would be something like the Financial Times, How to Spend It. So it's that kind of luxury lifestyle, culture, art, design, travel, that kind of world. So it's kind of speaking directly to the Business Post audience, but it also came with its own audience from historically being its kind of standalone title previously, when it was bought by our studio. Before that, it was Harmonia. Before that, it was owned by Smurfit. So it's had very many different incarnations throughout. So it's more of a luxury lifestyle focus and probably across the board now, whereas would have been very purely probably female before. But it's a long and illustrious history, really.
Okay. You serve as a portfolio and brand content director at the Business Post and lead kind of cross-functional teams delivering major brand extensions. Talk me through that brand extension process.
It's kind of creating startups a lot because you are, Women of the Year is now 25 years going, but it's kind of taken, at least that time or 22 years to get it truly successful as well, because there's a real graft to these things and they operate almost like satellites in their own right. And they kind of have their own ecosystem that works for them. So brand extensions for a lot of media now involve obviously really events and live experiential parts to it, because it's lifting it from the sort of routine platform to something that people seem to want more of, which is definitely more engagement and more in-person experiences. So they, in terms of starting them up, they really come from, an idea. Then sometimes, for instance, this year, one of the things we set up was the Innovators Festival with Google. So that was a completely new, fresh idea that just was came off the back of an innovators list we started, and then was like, well, this could actually become something more of like an actual day event, at least, where you bring lots of different thinkers together and you talk about what's coming. And it's kind of, the idea would be that it's almost the anti-pendulum in terms of it's way more democratic than that, and also, but about inspiring people to think about what's, you know, and businesses about, you know, what's next. This is a place to kind of cross-pollinate and talk about what's happening. So those kind of things, they start with an idea, then you want to get partners on board, you want to flesh it out in terms of there's a whole load of content that then it will come with in terms of setting it up, in terms of delivering it on the day, and then obviously then post the event, it's kind of an ongoing thing. So they have all those parts to them, and then there's a whole, obviously, financial reasoning that they have to abide by too. So there's, yeah, a lot in them, but they're almost like mini worlds in themselves.
But then from the title owner's perspective, is it, you know, if you're taking something like Tatler, right, and you go, is the process kind of, I would say, supply side or demand side? So do Tatler go out and go, how can we create something that is true to ourselves and be more relevant? Or is it somebody that said, do they go out and say, here is something already in existence that we should put our name onto because it ties into where we want to go?
I think mostly it's about, you know, building the brand. So you're, you know, as a media company, you want to be relevant in, particularly in certain spaces. So something like Women of the Year would have been like, you know, brilliant because it's been running this long. It's like, well, we own the space now because we've been doing it so long, but we're, you know, and you have to really work on the credibility where you're saying, you know, this is, you know, the most sort of definitive version of this that you could find, because there will be others in the market potentially. But it's really about actually, mostly it's stuff that it will come from either a content piece, and it's not necessarily latching onto something that's out there, but you're seeing, well, there is potentially a market for this, or people are more in, this is a good place where people can actually do something in person together that will bring people together, that will also bring lots of good feedback to the brand, but then also be something that is of value to your audience, basically.
Yeah. And like when it comes to that, you know, can every brand have some form of extension, or do you just think there's certain things you just kind of go, no, it is what it is and it ain't going any further?
I would think everyone could. And I think it's such an important part of where the direction of travel now at this point, because I think, you know, look, it's, I mean, there's so many shifts and there's constantly shifting, and, you know, obviously AIs are another big challenge. But the thing you won't ever replace is that personal experience, and that is of value to anything, and you can make it as small a niche. So for instance, as editor of Irish Tatler, I set up The Watch Club, which is an extremely niche thing, and it was about bringing people together who were really like nerdy and into it, and it was a safe space to like completely nerd out on that stuff, but also brilliant, amazingly interesting stories all around that stuff. And so, but that's super niche. Like, you'd have about 1500 members, and it's small in comparison to other things, but it makes a huge amount of sense always, I think, to try. And I think also, there's a different level of connection with a brand when you have those real touch points, because everything can feel quite removed otherwise. And it's just, there's just no comparison to having that moment. Like, Women of the Year absolutely works like that, where we are in front of people, they can see who we are. There's a level of kind of bond that gets created, and that's really valuable to both sides.
But I suppose the flip side of that is, like, with success comes the risk of distraction, that you're just kind of, you're always going to just slap the logo on anything.
Yeah.
And at what point is there a point where you reach the curve and you go, actually, the marginal utility of slapping the logo on something else from a brand extension isn't there, because it starts to have a detrimental impact on what you've done and been successful on in the past?
Yeah, you have to be careful, for sure, because each one, particularly something like live events, you are, you know, you're naked to everyone to fall on your face, you know. So it's a risk taking situation in that if it backfires, it'll really hurt you, and you know, in term, you've got to be really, you know, even like that in every part of the process, be really like diligent about how you manage all that, and definitely what you associate with and what you, you know, where you steer it. And yeah, you can't just go watering it down with any kind of, you know, let's just hop on this or give it a go. You have to try and keep an, you know, that's important from the get go. I mean, I'm sure any brand of any kind would know that too, that like those first few steps you take, that they are done well is going to serve you ultimately.
But then the other thing too is, I suppose it's really important as you do those brand extensions, as the brand owner, you keep control of what the extensions are, because you don't want it going beyond and suddenly you find the Tatler name is on something and something bad happens and you have, and it's no. Basically goes the other way against you.
No, well, we would rarely lend the name to anybody. It would always be our own event. Yeah. So you keep on top of that and you control what's out there, because they're all content pieces as well, which is something you want to be in and you want to be driving and it bringing back something to you and to your audience. Mm. So yeah, I mean, yeah, you definitely have to be careful of that.
And then typically how long, you know, when you're looking at these these brand extensions, and you mentioned the awards, you know, they're 25 years, you know, is there any sort of a gauge as to how long it takes before they can kind of stand on their own and be their own thing, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, well, 25 years.
Yeah, but you could say, you know, the awards ceremony is its own thing now, right? Yeah. So the fact that it's Tatler on it is neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it is a thing in and of itself.
And it can take years because you were having to come back again and again, and sort of you're kind of remaking the point each time that like this is what this is about, and then more, and it is almost just a word of mouth thing. I mean, the funny, you know, the part about events is that, you know, you have the reach of what's in the room, and it's quite hard to then also communicate that experience to anyone who isn't in the room. So you're sort of slightly limited. So you almost, it is quite a slow burn process, because you're like, you know, you want to do all the right things in the room at that time, so everyone, you know, people will just automatically want to come back, or they're going to tell other people, or, you know, and obviously that the brands you're working with are also happy about how it works. So yeah, it can take years, and you know, it's tricky because you've got to be able to support that for that time. You know, it's not always going to be an easy win.
Yeah, but like if you take the example of the awards, is there a symbiotic then relationship in terms of, you know, when you first started off, the awards were the new thing, and to a certain extent what was the draw to it was the Tatler name coming along. But now, because it's standing on its own, there's actually a feedback loop in terms of content on the night can then be put back into the magazine, and you get this kind of virtuous circle.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, I mean, like for the first while, I mean, I think it's almost as well that time is kind of caught up in a good way with it, because at first I think it was a very hard sell, like back in 2001, whatever, 2000. It was, the appetite for it was different. And, you know, there was always kind of, I think, the feeling it had to explain, you know, why do you need this and what is this about? And, you know, so it was a hard slog for those times. But I think as time has gone on, it's sort of seen more as like, well, this actually does matter, and it is good to support it. And there's kind of been more openness to it. But yeah, I mean, you kind of, it takes, and it's never an absolutely sure thing that it will ever evolve into something where it's completely kind of, you know, financially completely makes sense and all the other things. But you just got to, you know, but if you put in the graft, definitely early on, and there is those good relationships, you can get there.
Mm. And do you think that whole thing about, you know, some forms of brand extension are absolutely a necessary endeavor now, given the competitive landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I think without question, and they have been for some time. I mean, you'll see something like Vogue World or whatever, like an event like that, that's multi, can be kind of global for a day. But that in itself is kind of testament to the fact that you need that kind of level of impact and relevance and endorsement from other people who are, you know, relevant right now to really be felt still. And because other, you know, a lot of that stuff, it's all going to obviously filter down to multiply through different channels and remind people of why you're here and why you make sense. And yeah, you've got to have those, you've got to have those live events as part of what you're doing. I think no matter what at this point, I don't think there's any choice about that. But it, in a way, it's also probably one of the most exciting parts of the business too, because obviously when you know publishing and there's a certain amount of ground that you've covered in that, and you know, you understand it to a degree, it's never the same and it's never boring, which is great. But the, you know, in a way, the whole experiential or events element of things has been the kind of new frontier for brands to experiment with, reaching different people with different ideas, with, you know, how content can work in a different way, lifting it out of the kind of original platform and sort of reboxing it and make it, you know, really engaging in a different way. And I think that's actually been one of the kind of exciting parts of the direction things have taken, because it's more there's pressure to it, but it's also like such a great way of getting in front of those people.
Talk to me about the digital versus physical publications, because you obviously manage the digital transformation, if you will, in terms of publishing. So talk to me about that, and, you know, that balance of, particularly when you have the legacy of a printed edition for so long and a cohort of readers who are used to getting the physical, right?
Yeah.
You know, but you don't want to miss out on the digital opportunity. So talk me through that.
Yeah, I mean, they're just almost completely different worlds. Yeah. You know, you just approach them so completely differently. So, you know, creating a magazine, a sort of physical entity that's going to stick around potentially, is like, you know, you're curating something and it's very visual and you know, particularly from a lifestyle content point of view, it's, you know, you're very, very focused on the visual element of it, and you're planning it, and it's months, and it's, you know, time consuming. But yeah, you know, it's this one sort of digest of ideas in one place. And then, yeah, digital is so much more snacky in general, you know, particularly around lifestyle content. It obviously moves at a completely different pace. Your writing is even different for it. You know, the visual is not the biggest part of it always. It's really about the information more, and kind of, you know, being, you know, hitting a certain wave of a trend or, you know, an appetite for something. So it's really, yeah, they're just so different, because one is also in general more long form and one is much more short form too. So you just would approach them in absolutely separate ways, really. They're just not, like when Irish Atlas first came to the Business Post, it was just a print piece at that time because of where the website was at. But it was engineered in such a way that was so print focused in that way, that when you would go to replicate that online, you would do something completely different.
But also presumably the consumption patterns, physical versus digital, is very, very different. So if I'm getting a quarterly or a monthly magazine, I kind of am able to, it's there, and I'll flick through it when I want to. Whereas the digital world is so much about, I want real-time stuff and I want it now, and then, oh, that's great. But when I look at it tomorrow, I want fresh stuff. So the production cycle is much faster.
Absolutely. I mean, it's here and gone in terms of the digital element. And that's why you're not going to give it the same level of like love and attention that essentially maybe a magazine would get, because it's so, and there is still such a, And it is final. I mean, that's the thing about print. It's done. Like, if you're not going to change it once it's out there. So you have to be absolutely committed to
how it looks and what's in it and everything.
And that it's perfect and there isn't a mistake in there or an error or whatever, because you can't take that back. Whereas online, obviously, you can rewrite that. You can change it. You can. They're so different in that exacting nature of print. And just that, you know, the kind of there is a huge amount that gets chewed up in online in that way. And there's a speed to it, definitely. So you have to completely that in that way as well. Yeah, just absolutely focus very differently in it.
And would you say there's much of an overlap between the two readerships, so the digital versus the physical?
Yeah, lots. But I think how people are reading it or what they're looking for in the digital part is so different to the magazine, in that you just don't. Yeah, you're just, and you know, that's the thing about digital, which is lovely, is that you can tell how many people are reading. Yeah. You can get all that feedback. You know where people are going in it, and you can follow their journey around it. But with print, obviously, and you know, you're never 100% sure where it went to. You know, you rarely, there's no real feedback loop in that.
You know, it went into an envelope and you know it went somewhere, but you never know whether the envelope was opened or the thing
read. Yeah, you just don't know. I mean, sometimes you will get definite feedback from things, but yeah, you know, people do, you know, it reaches all kinds of things, and but in a very passive way that you don't actually know where it went.
What's the harder role, the editorial or the strategic role?
I mean, strategy is probably always the, you know, editorial is like, it is such an amazingly pleasurable job in so many ways. I mean, it's so brilliant when you're someone who wants to have like loads of fingers in different pies, because you have to sort of bone up on so many different things. It's like, it's such brilliant mind food all the time. And the strategy thing is obviously, you know, and it can be more challenging in terms of, you know, how does anyone make anything that's completely new ever? You know, so much stuff has been done. So it's a different, you need to give yourself a bit of time and space to sort of work those things through and troubleshoot all that stuff. And it's a very kind of different brain space, I would say. But really exciting in terms of being able to create new possibilities. But probably while you get skilled as an editor and you can keep honing those skills with strategy, I think you're almost trying to keep that ground fresh all the time. And that's a real challenge.
Let's talk about the awards. What are the categories? We'll start there for an easy one.
Oh, there's a lot. There's 18 categories almost. And we've kind of grown them a little bit over the last few years, because some of the kind of core ones have always been, you know, fashion and design, art, literature, film and drama, business, entrepreneur. Then we've kind of knitted in newer ones like innovation. There's a Catalyst Award, which is kind of someone who's really an agent of change right now. We've also introduced a Women's Health Award, because this is kind of somewhere that's really at the cusp of like lots of new stuff that's happening and recognizing lots of the great work that's there. So it's kind of very varied. Obviously, we're trying to kind of scoop in as many roles and walks of life and stories that are really worth telling that are out there.
But you can probably find, you know, women that could be going into 5 or 6 categories.
100%. I mean, innovation is so broad. Like, you're in business and you're innovating, obviously, or you're an entrepreneur, you're innovating. There are multiple, people who are absolutely cross-pollinating all those ones. So, yeah, it's really trying to, it's a tricky process trying to keep strictly inside one certainly for certain people. So, but it's, you need to give yourself wiggle room, because some people are just, they have done such an exceptional thing in that year. You just need, you know, you need to find a way to recognize it.
Yeah. And then would you say there is a couple of common criteria across all of the categories?
Yeah, I would, I mean, Obviously, we're very strictly within the last 12 months is what we look at. So I suppose it's where they have broken new ground is the big, always the big kind of calling card for something like that, because you're trying to, you know, a lot of the stuff we're trying to actually also talk about is quite hopeful in that, you know, so you're trying to say, look, things may be difficult and what, but there's all these solutions coming out of all these places, and these are these amazing people who are doing them. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of the time it's that, it's people, and also I suppose where they've really put themselves out there. So a lot, you know, it's one thing, I suppose, to have a job you really love doing and you've done that very well for a long time, and that's included doing X amount of things that have been maybe significant, but being someone who's, you know, risked a lot, taken those chances, really also endeavoured to kind of, you know, do stuff that has helped, you know, equality for women and helped change the game a little bit, all that kind of stuff would be what you'd look for in all the categories.
With that 12-month criteria now, is there a chance that the you don't get somebody who has the lifetime award, if you know what I mean? Somebody who's done good stuff over the last 25 years, but nothing great in any one 12-month period.
It's difficult, but that's the thing. It's like you kind of have to... You have to stick to your guns to a degree, because it'll be so broad and open then. And we did have, there used to be a Hall of Fame award years ago, but it kind of felt like it was almost like the sort of, you know, get this person before they die type of award, which is not what you want.
Yeah.
And does someone want to be honoured for that reason? So that's why we've kept it like really current, really strictly in that time. And it's really about the stories of the things that have happened this year and recognizing those and, you know, that, yeah, keeping it really focused.
Okay. One of the awards you say is Business Woman of the Year. Mm. Bit of a strange question though, but do you think entrepreneurship is gender dependent?
No, definitely not. So we have business and we have entrepreneurs. Okay. So they're separate categories because we needed to divide them up because, you know, and I think originally when the awards were starting, those categories were, you know, they had to work hard to kind of really get this, you know, to be able to find the women who were really to be, you know, awarded in that. And since, you know, the award started, it's just grown and grown and grown and grown. And now you have just enormous amount of like choice in those and talent in those areas. So, I think since, you know, I think women in business has, you know, the confidence and the kind of pioneering elements have just kept getting better. So I think, but then, you know, there's those who are running businesses and then there are those who are kind of founding businesses and those. So we would treat those quite differently because I think it's, again, they're not always the same skill set. But it was also a way of like, there's so much here to recognize and it's really difficult to keep it to just one person.
And you know, like when you look back and say either the businesswoman of the year or the entrepreneur of the year, and you look back over, say, the last 10 years winners, right? Do you see a kind of a very distinctive common thread between those winners? Like a trait that you go up, there it is, there it is, there it is.
Mm. Yeah, to some extent. I mean, it's interesting because it all, when you look back at the you also see people's peaks and troughs, you know, because it can be their year for whatever reason. And then the market changes or something happens and it's not there, you know, the story completely changes a couple of years later. So it doesn't always, there isn't always that same thing chiming through. I mean, I think it's really the entrepreneur stories and also the entrepreneur. And then obviously how we had kind of separated out the innovation thing is, you know, there's definitely the things that track with those people who were, you know, really pushing the boat out on those ones that you would definitely see a year on, year out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come back to the thing about a more general one in terms of, you know, do you think many businesses miss or you know, their mistakes that they make when it comes to their brand or their marketing content? You know, when you kind of wear your own hat and you see people doing stuff and you go, Wouldn't have done that. Yeah.
I think what's tricky for anyone is that stuff is can be just be too generic. You know, it's trying to, you know, it is that slightly, you know, gonzo element of things that sometimes you miss in that people are willing to take risks of having more personality. And that's tricky because, you know, you do run, you do, you know, you potentially can run into hot water there. But I think because we're, you know, and it is, you know, all of us, it'll be, it's the running theme of our current times is, you know, we're in a content saturated era for sure. So it is about how you, break out from that. And do you, you know, trying to be more, maybe less risk averse and more, with more personality and more humor as well as always the tricky thing. So I think, there are, you know, I think it's just in general being, I would say quite, you just think, that just looks, it's too samey or it's too conservative, you know?
Do you think the content has been dumbed down too much because of the need to producing so much or the perceived need to produce so much? There can't be that much original content out there, right? So, or, you know, high quality original content. And if it becomes a commodity game, by default, the quality, you know, gets diluted.
Yeah, I think it's tricky in that. I guess you have, you know, every brand has to decide for themselves how much they want to, you know, drive it as a numbers game, or have, or the integrity in the brand itself is the core thing, and then you're going to get people backing you for that reason, as well as partners, or whatever, or do you go for the more lowest common denominator and just, so it's a question of, I think, you know, deciding what, where you are as a brand and what you want in that way. And I think, you know, of course there's a certain amount because of the mass amount of it that it feels like it's, but I think it feels like, and probably people would say maybe music is the same, but I think there's probably a huge amount of quality that out there. It's just the tricky part is finding it always, you know, because it's can be buried in all the other noise that's going on.
Yeah, it's become too ubiquitous almost. How do you think the culture of Irish tattler has changed over the years?
Well, I mean, absolutely huge in terms of, I mean, originally in 1890 when it was started, to the best of my knowledge, the writers for the magazine were given women's names. They were actually men.
Right.
And we were had like a nom de plume of women because women were not working.
Yeah.
And there weren't female journalists at the time. So ironically, they were adopting these personas. So that's changed. But it's really, it's fascinating because, you know, there's this whole arc in terms of the title and the magazine and the content that follows the culture of, follows our culture. So, and it obviously predates our independence. So you've got the kind of early years of being still, you know, a subject of the British Empire, essentially, and sort of following that line a bit more. But there was really brilliant kind of early elements of sort of, equality about it. They used to have a column that was like the Women's Parliament that would discuss issues that were, women's suffrage, all that kind of stuff. Essentially it was created as a kind of a catalogue initially, and it was there to sell things to the new up and coming sort of slightly upper middle class women and you know, women of the house, obviously. So, you know, when you go back to those issues, you know, you're just, it's like 40, 50 pages of ads, which, you know, in an 80 page magazine, for instance. So the half of it was just like, you know, Lion's Tea and, you know, everything, and everything hand drawn. I mean, everything in it was, you know, in terms of the, you forget that there was actually no pictures until like the 70s, practically in 60s, there was a bit, but like it, before that, a lot of it was all hand drawn. So it's really, so much of it is, you know, we're so it, you know, modernized by everything we have now. But I mean, it's so interesting to look back. But it, so, you know, then it went through, obviously, then there was the kind of rising and, you know, they put that on the front cover of that issue and they have this amazing photograph of O'Connell Street in ruins from the Easter Rising. And it's a brilliant capture of a piece of history. And so it was definitely relevant to me. I wasn't just trying to talk about, you know, the fashions in Paris or whatever it was. I mean, there was all that too. So it had all these kind of interesting elements and that kind of kept going. And then, you know, and then through the sort of 40s, 50s, but then it gets to the 60s and it's focusing much more on Irish town. And there's obviously a more of a confidence in the country as well about our own sort of culture and style and all that stuff. And that really builds then through the 70s and 80s. And there's great stuff then, reportage around, you know, all kinds of, you know, sort of stories in the 80s from various things of, you know, scandalous stuff that was going on. So it's really fun in that way. But yeah, it just, you know, so it's gone through a lot of incarnations in that sense. But I mean, essentially it was keeping that kind of lifestyle element was sort of the core part of it.
It never really went down the gossipy type of thing.
No,
right.
It was never, I mean, you know, it would have had personalities on the cover and that was still a part of it, but never was that kind of, you know, it was never that sort of, you know, Heat magazine element or anything even close. It was all much more, and because it was a monthly, it was always more about kind of predicting what was coming in the next month for, and, you know, and trying to be a bit like a trendsetter in that sense. But it wasn't gossipy in that way. Yeah.
Do you think then that that kind of clarity of purpose as one of the reasons it's lasted as long? Because there can't be too many magazines that have that longevity.
No. Well, I mean, it predates Vogue, which is pretty amazing, just by a couple of years. But yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, there's been lots of people along the way, custodians of it, who've really believed in it and really backed it, because, you know, would have, it takes a huge amount to keep something like that going, you know, through, I mean, I remember, you know, during the crash, which is when I started on the magazine first, it had just, it was the end of 2009. And, you know, it was just the absolute sort of shrinking in terms of what the volume they'd been used to and had been there in terms of this advertising. It, you know, it was such a shock, and, you know, trying to pivot from all those things. But, you know, it's been, yeah, it's essentially been each publisher's had it, has had to kind of breathe new life in it for a new era, for a new audience, always that behind it, you know?
Yeah. You know, readers and customers are great at telling you what's wrong with the product, but not necessarily great at telling you what the solution is. So, so when as you sit down as an editorial team, how do you go through that process? Because you'll always get cranks. Cranks will always ring you up and go, I hate that, I hate that, right? And the people who love the stuff will never ring you up and say, oh, I love the stuff, I love the stuff, you know? So how do you balance and you know, give credibility to the cranks, but not enough, not a load of credibility to the cranks?
You know? Yeah, I mean, you definitely have to take on feedback, and some, and, you know, it's worth doing sometimes, because you're, it can strike a chord and you're like, do you know what, actually that we are missing a trick there. But I mean, it's a funny one in that there is no perfect format way of doing that. It is always a judgment call, and that's the thing about, like, certainly the job of an editor is, it, you know, you kind of have to live and die by the sword, and you're going to have to take the heat for that, because it is ultimately your choice and it is ultimately a choice, and there is no, it is just your opinion that that's a good idea, you know, ultimately. And so it you're always having to kind of try and trust yourself and be kind of sure as much as you can be, and be it challenges you a lot in that way. But yeah, you know, it's good to get people's feedback, but you just have to kind of, and a big part of it is that kind of, you're always looking for trends in anything, and you've got to keep your brain wired to that all the time. So you're always going, okay, that I can see that, and now that we obviously have so much information about what everybody is looking at and everything, it's even more kind of overwhelming, but also interesting. And then you've got to constantly you've got a point, you know, you're always following where those things are going.
So when it comes to your decision-making process, is it much more data-based or gut feel?
I think it would have been originally obviously very gut feeling, but like with sound, you know, information.
Yeah.
But now you definitely can, the numbers can definitely inform you so much more that, you know, you just wouldn't have had those insights before. I mean, something like the Watch Club was like, happened because I could see that people were reading this stuff that, and there was a real appetite, and there was, I already know, could see that there was not enough of that content elsewhere. So that's an obvious kind of opportunity. So you it's definitely a bit of both, but it, yeah.
The risk would be going the full data route is it becomes very formulaic, and it kind of, and it's not, you know, it's ultimately not, you're not publishing a book of code, if you know, or a computer code, right? You're actually publishing something that a person wants to read.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah. And it's kind of that perspiration and inspiration element of like, you want, yeah, great to give people what they want, but also you want to give them something they didn't know that they wanted also. That's the real, you know, sweet spot, really.
Do you obsess about the small things?
Yeah, I mean, God, I've had too many sleepless nights over something I thought was maybe going out, something that print, you know, that like printing, yeah, when you feel maybe you missed something or somebody's name, or those kind of things will kill you. And yeah, I've had way too many. I mean, particularly when I took the job on first, I mean, I just lived and breathed my job. That was it. I thought about it all the time. I thought about it when I was asleep. I thought about it in the morning. I thought about it every part of the day. And it just helped me. I mean, I needed to do that because it was like a full assimilation. And you kind of almost become the brand in a weird, like there's little separation between you and it, because you kind of just, it's like a living, breathing thing, and you just have to kind of inhabit it. So there was, yeah, it was 100% obsessive. Mm. Yeah.
And when it comes to you know, running the editorial team and the wider team in general, you know, is your approach hire talent from without or develop from within?
I think you need both. I mean, I think there's a great, like we definitely had really good experiences with kind of getting kind of sometimes they, you know, a graduate in, or they were an intern. Someone was just really keen to learn, and then you grow them from that place, and that's a really rewarding thing, I think, as well, because you know, you kind of forget, well, maybe how much you know or what you think you know, whatever, when you're so used to it. But then you're like, oh, actually, you know, you can share this with someone, it is going to be of value. And so the growing process from within, I really enjoy, I have to say. So but it can work both ways. I mean, talent from without sometimes just obviously brings a whole load of experience you don't have, and it's good because you kind of need to shake up the dynamics as well.
How do you feel about what you've already done with the title?
I mean, yeah, I feel, I mean, certainly the last iteration, obviously, that it's in, being in the Business Post, for me, was the closest it's got to kind of the most perfect thing I would feel. I mean, we were very lucky to get a lot of freedom with that. And it was, you know, a really, really enjoyable experience. But, it, you know, actually coming off the newsstand, which was where it was obviously before, which can be quite restrictive in that you're really governed by, if you decide to, can be governed as well by certain rules of how covers on newsstands work. You know, there was a kind of formula that it was working to. When you take that out and you're kind of a part of a, coming with a paper and you're a supplement, and you just can be much more creative with what you do. So that's been brilliant, actually.
And more so then when you move to digital.
Yeah. And then you're, yeah, exactly. Then you kind of lifts it all again, and you can really play with the, you know, with the platform and trial out things that you're doing. And obviously a huge amount of that is with social as well. And yeah, so, but I'd say that, you know, in a way, Women of the Year Awards is probably the thing I'd probably be most proud of in some ways, that it's been, you know, it's still going and it's having its most successful year so far. So, yeah.
And on that point then, who have been some of the most impressive women that have won the awards over the years, in your opinion?
Oh, God. There's so many. And the most recent years are the ones that are always freshest in my mind. But loads. I mean, we just, there's, you know, anyone from, like, there was Katrina O'Sullivan who won a couple of years ago, who's, you know, so inspiring in terms of where she's come from with her story and what she's done. Then we've had, yeah, the likes of, like, in the business category, like people like Karen May of XOcean, who have created these extraordinary innovations. We had Coreflow last year, who are, have created this extraordinary kind of, you know, this breastfeeding monitor for, you know, for women to know that the amount of milk babies are getting, and it's going to be like revolutionize that whole experience. But then, yeah, I mean, we've had last year our overall women were women of honor, who had gone through so much to kind of get their story out there and kind of break the whole cycle of shame that they were in. We had the year before, it was Una who had created new, been pushed for new legislation around stalking, who kind of really put themselves out there. So there's just, each one is kind of an extraordinary story in every time. So you're, yeah, it's really inspiring. Each one, every year, just can't believe that you can sort of top the last one in terms of the women that are out there doing what they're doing. But it, yeah, it's amazing. You can.
Have you ever thought about or really come close to going off in a completely different direction in your career?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's definitely something I toy with. I mean, how massively different, I don't know, because, I mean, even running events feels like a very different skill set to being an editor in many ways. Like, it's a bit, you know, it's much more of a project management experience, and it's very different in that way. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of, you know, at the same time, I like most, I mean, I started out as a writer originally, obviously, and, you know, as a journalist, but yeah, I kind of think I'll, you know, at some point I'll get that West of Ireland cottage and just like write that book that I'm
going to
write.
Yeah, I was going to say, could you go back to the shop floor and go back to writing?
Oh, I'd love to. I mean, if you were able to do that day in, day out, it's great work. Like, yeah. It is such a privileged thing to be able to do for a living, is write.
Yeah.
It's not, it's actually really, really hard as well.
Oh, I know. Mean,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, it's definitely not, I mean, it's funny, it's kind of, maybe particularly because of our culture, we're very slightly blasé about writing. But I mean, sitting down with a blank page is probably the most terrifying thing you can do to yourself, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think, but it's, yeah, it's such an incredibly relaxing experience ultimately, and rewarding thing to do. So, yeah. Yeah.
We're going to have a dinner party, 6 people, you, me and 4 others. Who would the other 4 be? And
oh
why?
My God. Okay. Wow. I'm to think of the, I think I'd like Keith Richards as one of them.
Okay.
From a totally wild card point of view. Just for the stories. Who else would you, oh my God, I'm trying to think of like those great, yeah, I mean, like Maya Angelou, someone like that. I think I'd have, yeah, maybe like a crazy artist like Tracy Emin or like Vivienne Westwood or someone.
Would Anna Vinter ever appear on the list?
Well, she probably, I'd say she's actually great crack once you get to get there.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much work you'd have to do at that point. So yeah, it depends how up for it she'd be.
Right, we've come to the final question. Right, I'm going to open up the book and see what we've got. Oh, right. This is an interesting one. I'm an interesting woman, actually, as it happens, is asked this question. How do you make sure to maintain good and positive mental health? And do you practice what you preach?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, good question. I don't always. That's the truth. I think, like most people, you try to, but it's not a reality all the time. I think I would say that I prioritize my relationships, and that's my way of kind of keeping my mental health. Because if that's sort of the biggest sort of nurturing element that I'd have in my life outside work, I really love what I do. But yeah, my relationships would be the way I'd try and keep things on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd like to thank my guest, Jesse Collins. I also like to wish everybody on Saturday night the best of luck in the Tatler Women of the Year Awards. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe and comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.